everyone, and welcome to Minute 92 of Season 7 Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Dave Palace of 5 Minutes of Mystery. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
You got a AAA card?
We'll get there. Minute 92 begins with the truck crashing into the tree line and ends with John trying to deal with a dead Misha. So we ended things yesterday with basically the car flipping over and trying to wait and see what's going to happen with John, with Zeus, with Eric, and with Misha, because now we have two cars that have been disabled. As we mentioned yesterday, no other cars were injured in the filming of the scene.
Thank God.
which is sort of a little bit, unbelievable, but why not? I mean, we see other cars like swerving out of the way or anything like that, but nobody even tries to stop to see what's going on.
Man, New York drivers, they really don't care. They're like, I gotta be somewhere, buddy.
Apparently, that's crazy the way that they do it. And we see the truck basically crash into like some trees or whatever, and the back wheel is just spinning. It's continuing. Misha's still applying, even though he's dead. He's applying pressure to the accelerator, and I guess the car must be in neutral at this point because it's got no way to move forward or anything like that. Because if it was in drive, it would have still tried to. Actually, could have been. Maybe it's in drive.
I mean, it's just in that mud, and I guess it just however it's positioned. Like, I mean, they're lucky. Yeah, the axle and the front isn't busted because they got to use that later to get back to the boat.
Well, okay, but we don't know that.
Okay, we don't know that, but I mean, I'm trying my best. All right.
No, it's. I mean, it's funny. I mean, we sort of glossed over yesterday when I was reading from the script, the fact that they stole another car, they stole a station wagon. They just left like a woman on the side of the road, just like they did with the guy in the Mercedes. So, John likes to improvise, he's moving from car to car without a problem,
God, yeah. I mean, I know. Al said in the second movie, but he's right about the insurance companies. Like, how many people are calling up that their car got crashed or there's something got something, and they're mentioning like, yeah, it was a guy with a receding hairline and like a New York police badge, and everyone's like, and all the insurance companies like, oh my God, was it McLean? Oh my God, he's costing us so much money.
Yeah, that's a good point. But it's the police that get to pay for all these things. You don't even need insurance for it.
Guys, yeah, he's causing Walter gives him so many ulcers.
Basically.
Poor man.
Yeah. And so at this point, we see the Mercedes is just flipped over. The door has shut somehow, even though, yesterday we saw that it was open. And then we see John, and John is actually hanging upside down, which means that he was wearing a seatbelt. But Zeus is not.
He has the seatbelt wrapped around his arm. That's about it. You're right. He must have been. You know what he must have done? He must have tucked and like just balled up the buttoned in. He must have tucked and then he tied it like a rope around his arm or his wrist and just held on to the seatbelt that way.
Right. What movie is that? Isn't there a movie?
You gotta dodge the gunfire.
What movie is that where you have a character? Ah, I know what it is. It's Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom, where he mentions to Short Round, that he's gonna cut the bridge. So Short Round like wraps his hand around the ropes around his hands, that type of thing. So I guess he's doing a short round here. That's what Zeus is doing.
He's ducked in cover because he doesn't want to get shot, so he has to duck himself lower below the airbag so it doesn't like blow his head off, and then he probably just grabs the seatbelt and he holds on to it as the only like stable form frame, and he just is like hangs on for dear life. So that's why he's like up in that position. He wasn't really using the seatbelt as it intended.
Right, it's true. And then John says, oh, what the f- happened? And then he says to Zeus, "You got a AAA card." So what do you know about AAA?
Oh, yeah, sure. My family, like, we're members of it, and I've had to use it. I think I've had to use it maybe twice.
Do you
Once
know
I had to use it for a, yeah,
what does
what?
AAA stand for?
Oh, Jesus. American Automotive Assistance?
American Automobile Association. Very good, very close. I actually
Okay.
always thought it was the Automobile Association of America. That's what I always thought. So
Yeah.
I got that wrong. Do you know what year they founded it?
Oh, goodness gracious. I would say late 50s. Am I right?
1902.
02. Wow, that's smart. Someone long time ago figured out I'll make money assisting the people that drive the cars
That's right.
with a premium. That's like the guys that sold the mining tools to the miners that wanted to pan for gold. It's like,
Exactly.
hey, you might find gold out there and you're gonna need these supplies. The same thing. Hey, you might buy a car and you're gonna need some assistance with it. So that's very smart. That was a very smart move.
That's right. So it was founded in Chicago, and there were nine motor clubs that had a total of 1,500 members, and they banded together in order to form AAA. And so they had the Chicago Automobile Club, the Automobile Club of America, the Automobile Club of New Jersey, the Automobile Club of Buffalo. So there was a whole bunch of them, and they just banded together in order to try and find a way to, I as you said, make money off of all the drivers. They started giving roadmaps in 1905. They started publishing them, and they started a school safety program in 1920. I mean, they really were they found a way to use this as a cash cow with the whole thing. It's unbelievable.
This makes so much sense, and this also I feel like goes into the whole Michelin star thing, because I do know the idea is that Michelin was giving like they had their booklets of like where to go and what to do. It was like the early travel brochure catalog, and they were pretty much like the Michelin star was like, this is what we consider the best restaurant. If you're driving through Chicago, this is the best restaurant, and so forth. And so it's obviously those restaurants were like, we want to get on that catalog because then we will now be nationwide known because there's no internet. So it's like every driver that buys a car and invests in traveling will come to our restaurant and we will have the prestige of like being on that. So it all adds up. It's like everyone knew, yo, everyone's about to get really connected with each other. All these cities are about to get a lot smaller because everyone's driving around and there is money to be made, whether it be through roadside service, whether it be through recommendations of what to do when driving through. It's amazing, like the American highway system and just how like just those business ideas boomed.
Correct. It really is. And during the Jim Crow era, so AAA discriminated against African Americans, who and they weren't allowed to join the association. So they had an alternative to a AAA guide. Do you remember what it was called?
I mean, I wouldn't know.
You would. You definitely would know.
I would.
Yes.
I mean,
Think of a movie that won Best Picture in 2017.
oh, The Green Book? Oh,
Yep.
The Green Book. Is that it?
That's right.
Oh,
Green
shit.
Book.
I mean, no, I didn't watch it, but like now I thought, okay. Oh, there you go. I thought The Green Book was about a book about the guy who's telling about it. Like, oh, I drove this guy around. But okay, Green Book.
No,
Okay,
it's
I
the
get it
idea
now.
of where can African Americans go while
Yeah.
they're traveling, like where can they stay and things like that. Similar to what
Yeah.
AAA was doing.
Yeah. And I know it's a shame of segregation.
Right. Well, we're not going to be able to solve
No, we can't solve that.
the racial history of AAA,
No, we can't.
in the short amount of time that we have. So,
I'm glad
but
we addressed it. I'm glad
yes.
we made note of it, and I'm glad we all learned a little bit from it. But we have to, the more important thing is we got to find the key to this bomb.
That's right. And then the shot changes, and we're back in the school. We're in the Chester A. Arthur school, and we see the we get a shot of the principal with Cobb, Principal Martinez, and she says, "I got the janitors making a last sweep of the building right now." Thank you, Miss Martinez. It's a short little scene, but it's important for us to, you know, for them to tell us that what we're about to see, because the scene, well, because then the next scene that we see the janitor who we've already met briefly in previous minutes. You know, he didn't say anything, but he was standing there, so we knew who he was. You know, now we see him going into one of the classrooms.
Yes.
Now, did you notice before he gets into the classroom that there's like arts and crafts on the wall there? Did you notice what it says?
Can you read the coded messages? That's funny.
And what does it say above that?
Oh, Wamham belt?
Wampum belts.
Oh, Wampum belts. Oh, yes. Okay. They're clearly going over. Native American history and the class, because I remember doing stuff about this, about like the Algonquins, about the Lenape, Seneca. I remember doing all that, and that fourth, fifth grade, I remember doing all my history classes about that. So that's great that like that's what they're learning too. They're learning about the history of like the tribes that lived in the area.
Right, exactly. So wampum is a traditional shell bead of the Eastern Woodlands tribes of Native Americans, and it includes white shell beads hand-fashioned from the North Atlantic channeled whelk shell and white and purple beads made from the quahog or Western North Atlantic hard shell clams. So again, if you look at the picture, you can see in the movie, you could see that there are purple beads and there are white beads and things like that. So it's very interesting, you know, that they did this. The they have found beads that have been dated from before 1500. It goes all the way back, and before Europeans landed in America. So they would use wampum beads for storytelling and things like that. So it's interesting, the idea of them saying, can you read the coded message? Meaning, my understanding of that is that each of these beads says something else, so that you can try and relay some sort of story through the whole thing. Which, again, we see it just for a fraction of a second, but it's just great. It just jumped out at me. You know, the whole thing, can you read the coded message? And I'm like, what coded message?
I love that. Yeah, a little the hint to the film, the just the real world tactile of like that's what kids would be studying. They would be studying the history of the land and the area. Okay, so I want to tell you something that really hit me now. Just so we go back to Martinez and Walter. I love this shot. I love them being filmed through the wire, of the safety wire of the inner city school. I think that's a great shot that you just see this, like, you know, they're focused, but you see that wire, and I think, and then also how calm they are. I love it. You know, they're being practical, you know, responsible adults for these kids. Correct. But then, and also when you cut to the janitor, he opens the door, you see his wire glass on the door. When you pan through the classroom, it's empty, but you see the windows have wire glass on them. And I think,
and one of the windows is even open,
and you could definitely see the wires. So it's like they have wire glass, they have exterior wires. And I think what's great about that is your brain is realizing if you lock this building down, you can't get out or in. This is not like, oh, I'll just jump out the window. You can't. This school is designed so people cannot break in, and it could be locked down in case there's something that goes wrong. And it's like that's now going to be working against the staff, because now they're bottlenecked about getting these kids out. They can't just tell everybody, on the count of three, we're all going to jump out the gymnasium windows or something onto, like, you know, mats. It's like, no, this whole place is wired and locked down. You now have to, like, we're going to have to get all these kids, keep them safe and calm, and then we're going to tell them, run out the building.
That's right.
So I just love this little, the little visual detail of just showing that our characters are locked in, and then we're about to see that these kids are locked in.
Right, it's true. That's a great catch with that whole thing, because I didn't even think about that fact. It makes sense. And I mean, you'd think that the janitor would do a little more of a thorough search, than what he does. He, you know, just looking and then locking the door and then walking away calmly. And then, you know, we see four kids show up from behind this desk. I mean, it's pretty amazing that they were able to hide so easily there.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that, yeah, I got four kids, even though they're like, yeah, like 7 and 8 or whatever. Like, the fact, like, yeah, they hide so well. And I mean, he's just one janitor. And look, Larry, here, let's scroll back. Like, he's, when he opens that door, it says Mrs. Feldix, class 406, room 504. So it's like we are on the fourth or fifth floor, depending on how they number the classrooms.
Correct.
So if the gymnasium and the office maybe and like the nursing office would be like maybe rooms 101, 102, 103, assuming all the 101 buildings are like office administration, you would probably start the classrooms on floor 20 something. So it's like this is several floors up. And you now have to think about like how many classrooms, probably this one janitor who's most of the time just quietly mopping throughout the hallways. Maybe there's another guy. So maybe there's a guy on the other side of the building and they're kind of going in pairs, or I'll take floors this and that. You take floors that and this. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe he wasn't told that there's a bomb. Maybe they're just.
No, he knows. He was standing there when he's the one who told them about the.
Oh, yes. The
refrigerator.
Right. Yes.
So he knows
so,
about
okay,
it.
So he's being calm, but you're right. He's not focusing more. He's not saying, hey, anyone in here, I'm locking it up. Because maybe if he said that, the kids would be like, well, he's not a teacher. He is an adult. And maybe we don't have to tell him about the boombox or the fact that we ran away.
Right.
Like if he said something, maybe the kids would be like, he's not a teacher. So he may not. Like maybe they're like, you know, Mr. whatever his name is. Do you know his name is?
No, he's just known as the janitor.
Okay, because, yeah, I don't know if he ever said, like, oh, Mr. Something said that the fridge came in, you know, today. So, yeah, maybe he called out, just went in each room, said, hey, anyone in here, I'm locking it up, you know, fair shake here.
Which he doesn't do here. You know, that's
No, he doesn't. I think I'm going to have to put that on him, that he just did a look. I mean, he didn't think about, is anyone hiding in maybe, like, the teacher's closet, you know? Is someone hiding on the desk? Because I assume, you're right, I assume these rooms are very small, they're very sparse. You just have – yeah. Look, we have desks with – looks like, you know, probably history, depending on the Wanapi what is it called? Wanghim? Can't remember the name of it
wampum.
Right now. But anyway.
Wampum.
The wampum. Thank you. The wampum belts outside beads. This is probably history or social studies class.
Well, but they do have science. Exactly, because they have the solar system. They have a diagram of the solar system on the far wall.
Which is fine. You got hundreds of kids. Like maybe keep them in class and they just bang out one class.
No, I would think that this is just their homeroom, you know, because again it's elementary school, so it's not as if they're moving from class to class.
Yeah,
this is
you're right.
This is
yeah.
the classroom that they use for everything. Now,
that's true.
What I also find a little strange is why doesn't he turn off the lights in the room if he's already doing that? Because if you look at the light switches, they're all flipped up. And in order to turn off the light, you usually flip it down. You know.
Yes.
So you would think that if you would turn off the lights, then the kids would be like, "Hey, it's dark in here. You know, what's going on?"
Yeah. That actually. Yeah. And also, I think for his check, he'd be like, "Oh, all the lights are on. I'll turn each light off so I can look easily and see what classes I've covered or not."
And also, so that I don't have to come back later and turn off all the lights.
Yeah. Exactly. If school is dismissed. Like, I will have to come back here later and turn these lights off tonight. So I might as well just turn them off and leave it. So, yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. We're going to say it. Janitor kind of slacked on that.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Slacked as an adult checking out. Slacked as an adult keeping the kids safe. Slacked as a janitor managing the power. Because he's going to have to change those bulbs if they go out tonight.
That's right. Well, they're probably fluorescents, but still.
Yeah, but like it's on him. He left the light on.
Right, and then the kids come out from behind the desk, and then Dexter says, he goes, "All right, come on, all right, 5 stud, 3 9s, 1," and then he gets cut off. So obviously they're playing a game of poker here. And now, when do you think the first kind of playing card was created?
Oh God, I mean, we could be talking like. probably 1600s. I mean, this could be something from like old England, you know? This could be older than that. God, this could be, no, I take that back. I would say like turn of the millennium, like a 1100 AD, that kind of level.
It's even earlier than that. It's in China in the 9th century. That's when they started with the idea of playing cards.
Yeah, okay. I like that. Yeah, that makes sense.
And they came to the East in the 1300s. Mm-hmm. They found a dictionary which uses the term in 1371. And
interesting, cool.
Right. And then there were places which started banning, you know, playing cards, gambling games with cards and stuff like that. And I mean, I found so much information about this over the years, about where it really started. Because you had also you had cards that were known as the knave was the KNAVE was like the lowest type of card, and basically that was actually referred to as the prince, you know, which again is the jack. And
that's funny.
Yeah, and it's just amazing looking at the history of all this. But that in the U.S. that's where they introduced the idea of a joker, because okay. for the game Euchre. Have you ever played Euchre?
No, I love board games and card games, but specifically traditional card games, I'm very bad on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I know almost nothing.
Right. So that was created around the time of the American Revolution. And it the modern format of a 52 card deck, it started in France, where they decided, you know, to have four different suits. The suits change depending on where you are. Like in Italy, they're known as cups, coins, clubs, and swords. As they're also known that way in Spain, in Portugal. France is where they started what we know about hearts, diamonds, clubs, and spades. In Germany, they're hearts, bells, acorns, and leaves. And then you have in Switzerland and Swiss German areas, roses, bells, acorns, and shields.
Do you have anything with Japan? I'm very curious. Was Japan influenced more by anything from the Orient, or are they more influenced by American card playing after the war?
Well, in the Japan company, the company known as Nintendo, in 1889, mm-hmm. began to produce and distribute a game called Karuta, K-A-R-U-T-A. And they did it because they became more popular because in Japan they banned most forms of gambling in 1882. But this game, game you were still allowed to play. So they started creating...
That's interesting.
That's really interesting. I never knew that Nintendo was, you know, was a company long, you know, a century before it started dealing with video games. Wow.
Well, that's the thing, is that anytime someone talks about the documentary of Nintendo, they say it's 100 years, but they never talk about what they did. They just go like, they just jump right to the Famicom or like, you know, or their early technological stuff. So that's very interesting. Hey, you know what? Someone who's listening, if you're in school and they ask you to do a report on like the history of Japanese gaming from like the, you know, maybe 1800s through post-war to modern, I'd love to read it.
All right. Very cool. You could send that to Dave. he'll mark it up for you and, you know, he'll edit it for you.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, I don't want to punch your stuff up, but like, if you any ask, you want me to take a glance at it? You want me to forge a 100 for your parents to give you a good grade so they take you out to get a pizza? I'll do it. Don't worry.
Right. And then as they're starting to play cards, the shot changes and we're back on the road. We're back on the Sawmill River, the Sawmill Expressway. And you know, John is standing. We see the Mercedes upside down. We see John in the rain, standing in the middle of the road with a gun in his hand. There are cars that are still going by. He runs towards the truck. And did you see how Zeus just like runs across the road? It's like very funny. He's you know, he has his head hunched down and he's like limping across the road type of thing as he's trying to get there.
Oh yeah, I mean yeah, he's probably limping. Yeah, his back hurts from probably he got knocked into probably like the airbag or something when if it burst on them. Actually, no, I don't even know if his side had the airbags because I know they had that argument. Right,
that's true. Which they didn't even go out. You know, the airbags didn't even pop open at that point. But then John,
God, if one of the fuses they pop is like the airbag
sensor. Well, I actually learned something interesting just about a month ago. I went to go, you know, get my yearly test on the car, and the airbag light had gone on like the day before or something like that. And what they told me, I had to then go get it fixed. But they told me that when the light goes on, because there's a malfunction with one of the airbags, it turns off all the airbags. Okay, meaning thankfully, you know, we didn't have any accidents after that came off because the airbags just wouldn't have deployed. You know, so for anyone out there, if you see that there's a light on there and you're like, ah, it's no big deal, go get it taken care of. that's my friendly advice.
I mean, I get why they do it. They probably disable it so like it counteracts anything that could make them accidentally go off. Correct. If someone's driving.
Yes.
Because that would be it's better to say like, hey, these aren't on, go get fixed, rather than like these might pop at any
That's
time.
That's right.
Because that would be very bad. Correct. So, yeah, good safety. Yeah. Good safety for people.
So John runs over towards the truck and starts shooting into the truck a little more. And I love the camera work here. This is like Saving Private Ryan style, you know, camera work where it's jumping up and down with us. You know, and then
I love it. Yeah, it makes you feel like you just got out of the back of the car with them.
That's right. And John screams,
like you feel just as exhausted.
That's right. And John screams, "Stay down, stay low." And he gets over to the car and opens the door. And as he's opening the door, we see that Misha just like falls out with a lot of blood all over his face. And then John
puts
the gun on him.
Yeah, you're kind of surprised that like you're maybe he got the gun, but you're like, oh wow, he got the driver too. You're like, that damn, he's a good shot.
Oh, come on, it's John McClane.
It is John McClane.
Can't expect anything different from that. All right, and that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute?
No. I'm actually excited to talk about these the Hitmen tomorrow. So all right. let's get into it.
Okay. Well, first we have the script. So the script continues.
Oh, yes.
Yesterday we ended in the script with John and Zeus arguing because Zeus wants to go save his sons / nephews. And then McClane says, "Listen to me. The bomb's going to blow in 15 minutes. We're half hour out of town and the bridges are closed. We got to get the disarming code." Zeus says, "He gave us the disarming code. Remember that we talked about the book, right?" And then McClane holds up the book and says, "He gave us..." He says, "Zeus, we got to make Simon tell us what this thing's. He's going to give us the code. It's our only chance." The two men stare at each other. Zeus takes a deep breath. He floors the accelerator. Then it cuts to Taft Grade School in Harlem. Remember in the script, it's Taft instead of Chester A. Arthur. And it says, "Sirens wail. Police cruisers and fire trucks turn the corner. They barrel up, stopped in front of the school. The area is barricaded off. Cobb, Lambert, and Walsh step outside the school. Charlie Weiss of the bomb squad approaches Cobb. 'We've already checked this one, Arthur. Are you sure?' 'Yeah. I've got 50 guys in here. If it's here, we'll find it.' Everyone turns and looks at the school." And then that's all they have here. The stuff with the school isn't as prominent here as...
Okay.
You know. There are some stuff that they talk about in the script, but not as much. And then, okay. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Trilogy Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five trilogies, which, you know, I leave it wide open that my guests can choose how they want to define a trilogy from that perspective. So, what have you got for us, Dave?
Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I'm going. I kept playing with it. I kept, because I wanted to kind of like go off the usual, like Niall said, like, let's not bring up the usuals, because like my number one, yes, but we're gonna play Spinal Tap Rules. My top would be the Die Hard trilogy, specifically the Die Hard Ultimate Trilogy Silver Disc Box Set. That is the perfect Die Hard. Okay, and I know there's Blu-rays and there's 4Ks. And there's probably new collections. This is the perfect collection, because I think this exists perfectly in the DVD realm. I do not think this needs to get elevated anymore. I don't think I need any better clarity. I think a little bit of film grain. I think the perfect amount of special features. And me and Niall did not bring this up, but we've had a lot of discussions about this. This trilogy has the best DVD menu animations. And if you've never seen them, look them up on YouTube. Put in old Die Hard Trilogy Ultimate Collection intros. And we love the Die Hard the Vengeance one, because you're in a subway and the subway train's going by. And as you like click on different parts of the metropole of what you want to click, it'll take you into the subway car or something like that. But if you click movie, you hear honk honk. And you see that subway car coming, and then it crashes and explodes right into the thing, cuts to black, movie starts. And I'm like, that is how you excite the home audience when they put this DVD in. So it's like,
well, for sure.
So I'm like, so, and that's not even on, it's top of the list, not even considered in the top list. That's all top. But anyway, okay, trilogies. I did get a little experimental. You know, it's fine. I'll just make it one, because I just spent 10 minutes talking about it. It's number one. So what we'll do is I'll consider this next one the number two.
No, we'll go to five and work your way back up.
Well, that's the top. All right. So then, okay. All right. I got you. Right, I'm sorry. I got my cursor over my different ones here. Okay. So that's, we already know that's number one. Okay. Number five, I'm going to say Tremors. Now I know there's actually seven Tremors movies. I have watched them. I have watched the series. I am a Tremors fan. Don't get me wrong. I love Burt Gummer. And I think Michael Gross went from playing a satire character to having just a lot of fun for the next like 30 years. Okay. That being said, I think the trilogy is the most necessary ones, because the later ones, like the prequel one is okay. You can watch the prequel one because it shows you dirt dragons, which are mini graboids. That's cool. Okay. I would not watch five or six. Jamie Kennedy plays his son. It's not good. It's just as bad as Die Hard 5. Number seven, Shrieker Island. It is the last one in the franchise. Definitely the last one for Burt Gummer and Michael Gross. And they get rid of his son. I don't know if they kill him off or whatever it is. But they actually have him set up with the Napoleon Dynamite guy. I can't remember his name. John Heater, I believe. And they play a better team. They're way better. And they're supposed to be like, they probably film in Hawaii. It's supposed to be some tropic island that was like used as a game reservation by billionaires to hunt monsters. And they put graboids and other like synthetic, like, oh no, they're supercharged monsters now. It's, that one's fun. So I'd be like, watch it. But more specifically, watch the original trilogy of Tremors. Obviously, we've all seen the first one. Second one's kind of fun. It's more direct-to-video. Third one is definitely direct-to-video. But the Ass Blasters, I like them, and it's a shame that they don't get much play later in the franchise. It's like they didn't want to, like, oh, no, we made them fly. And it's just like, we made them fly. Like, that's kind of interesting. Play off of that. They only use it. It's only, like, really in the third one they talk about the flight of the Ass Blasters. Because you have graboids that they turn to – well, first, if you want to go the whole canon, it's dirt devils that then go into graboids that then give birth to Shriekers, which then go into a food coma and evolve into Ass Blasters. That's the full genetics. And then the Ass Blasters obviously could have dirt dragon graboid eggs inside them. So that's the whole. And the idea is they fly away and they're supposed to repopulate somewhere else. So anyway, that's number five. Number four, I'm going to say John Wick 1, 2, and 4. I like Chapter 3, but Chapter 3 is kind of like the middle ground of just like he's just learning more and doing more and having to kill more. But really, if you go 1, 2, then you jump to 4, you don't lose a lot of information there. You lose a little bit, but you don't lose a lot. And as much as I love the fight scenes in 3, it's like if you want to go from like a beginning, middle, and end, that is 1, 2, and 4, John Wick. Number 2,
How did you get to number 2? You had Tremors, and then you went to John Wick.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. See, that's what happened.
Now you're at number 3. Wrong.
Thank you. See, I got to renumber them because I was off. Okay, now number says that was five, that was four, that is – all right, here comes three. Okay, I'm sorry. Three, the Equalizer trilogy. They are perfect, like, dad films. It's Denzel. He's an older guy, but he still feels in control of his abilities, and I love how calm he is when he's beating these guys up. So if you've never seen Equalizer, the trilogy is really fun. I think the third one's really good. Him being in Italy and him kind of like, maybe I can live here, and then some like mafia guys come into town. He's like, I'm preparing you. You're about to get equalized, and you don't realize how bad it's going to be. So that's what makes – and that's a good trilogy. It, you know, it's not like an epic storyline. It's just a man who is, wants to – decides to do good for people. Okay. Number two, now there's been considered – there's two different names for it, but I'm going to go with the if the English get to call that the Cornetto trilogy, I call this the East Rail 177 trilogy. And this is the M. Night Shyamalan film that connects Unbreakable to Split to Glass. I think this is a great – Philadelphia, you know, fantasy comic book trilogy. I always get emotional.
Don't cry.
I know. As soon as I thought about it, I was like, I don't. But Unbreakable is such a good film. It emotionally rips me apart every time. So I always recommend people, hey, if you've never seen Unbreakable, I think that is one of Bruce Willis's best films. And he is not an action hero. He is a very sad man who doesn't know the purpose of his life. And a tragedy that comes into his life really makes him see his life and the world around him differently. So that's my perfect pitch for Unbreakable. And then go into Split, go into Glass. I have so many stories about seeing these films. Like 2019 started with Glass. And I was like I'm sure the Avengers film that's going to end later this year is going to be like a crazier film. But like this was – it was such a good twist because – we had no idea what would happen next, and I still think he's going to do one more movie in this universe. It won't be Bruce Willis or Sam Jackson be involved. I don't think any of the Ray characters will maybe be involved, but he's going to do something. I don't know.
So, Dave, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Yo, please, if you want to listen to me ramble, come on down to 5 Minutes of Mystery. I talk about the 1999 superhero comedy ensemble Mystery Men with Ben Stiller and Hank Azaria, Gene Garofalo, Jeffrey Rush. I mean, I think now that The Boys season 4 is concluded and you're like, oh, man, I would love to have more satire about comic books and superheroes, check out Mystery Men. I highly recommend it. You're going to be like, wow, that's in 1999. They're already telling some funny jokes before the big comic book Marvel event even happened.
All right. Very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. And you can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Johnny comes marching home again. Hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hoorah, hoorah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.